From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Lots to cover tonight.
Jason Martell is a world-renowned researcher and lecturer specializing in the ancient Sumerian culture, advanced technology there, and how it relates to Planet X. Backed by leading scientists from the mainstream scientific community, Mr. Martell has appeared on many television and radio programs, of course, including Coast to Coast. Looking forward, Mr. Martell is preparing to conduct several groundbreaking international research expeditions. His goal is to gain firsthand access to ancient Sumerian artifacts and other archaeological relics not currently accessible to the public. By bringing worldwide attention to these hidden artifacts, Mr. Martell hopes to usher in a new era in the ancient astronaut theory. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Jason, how are you?
Hey, George.
So many things going on. I was talking with my producer and I said, I've got to get the best researcher we can about some ancient engineering and technology. And
Wow. You
kept coming up, I'll tell
you.
So thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be back.
What have you been doing lately?
Working hard. And it's very interesting. Some of the things we'll be discussing tonight falls right in the lines of the ancient astronaut theory. It's funny how every day it turns out modern science is, ancient knowledge is slowly catching up with modern science.
Well, it's about time, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is.
You know, when you got involved in this a few years ago, did you have much resistance from the outside community?
Yes, very much so. As a college student, 29 now, as a college student, about 9-10 years ago initially getting into this, I suffered a lot of ridicule because, most people are not privy to this type of information and, are usually first off taken aback by it.
This planet, Jason, is about 4.5 billion years old. The civilizations that we're talking about are roughly how old?
Well, the ones that we're going to be discussing tonight only go about 6,000 years back, so there's a big gap there.
There sure is. Are you a believer in all that there is a possibility that we might have had civilizations living perhaps 1 million years ago, 10 million years ago, and for some reason there must have been some kind of calamity, they wiped themselves out, whatever might have happened, and then the civilizations crop back up again?
Well, it's an interesting point, George. I was just reading recently an article. I think it's actually been passed around several times that at some point there were actually footprints found that show modern man footprints walking along, let's say, Neanderthal.
Mm-hmm.
I actually even came across an article today produced out of Peru, interestingly enough, which we'll be talking about, that shows footprints alongside of what they believe to be dinosaur tracks. So there's a lot of stories, and you know the famous name Dr. Roger Lear, of course. I have some video footage of an event that he went and filmed down in Brazil of this gentleman that owns these stones, and basically these stones have been carbon dated to be I'm not exactly how they date stones, but they've been scientifically dated to be over 1 million years old, and they show depictions of man riding dinosaur and man walking along dinosaur. So these, of course, get a lot of scrutiny and skepticism because suggesting some information that doesn't swallow too well with modern science.
Well, you know, I had a guest on yesterday, Jason, who was talking about his theories of alien bases on the moon.
Yes.
And one of the big questions I continued to ask him, the possibility that maybe if there are bases there, that they are not alien, but that we might have built them from past civilizations from this planet who even developed the technology to get to the moon. And he said, you know what, George? Possible. Very possible.
I got to say one thing quickly, George, as a little bit of humor. I did realize that you had the guest on last night speaking of George Adamski's work, and I saw a quote today that I had to save and I thought was somewhat appropriate. I don't know if it's too much of a slap in the face for NASA, but I found this very amusing. basically a blind person reading Adamski's book in Braille has more of a cognitivity of what's going on in the solar system than NASA.
Is that an editorial slam, or is that just something you're reading?
I'm just something I read, and I thought it was extremely interesting in the fact that if you think about it in the eyes of, let's say, a blind person reading about all the wonders and beauty of our universe, especially through the unrestrained words of someone like Adamski, for instance, not being able to confirm or deny what he says, versus the dry, bland explanation by NASA, I can see how a blind person reading in Braille what Adamski has to say versus a NASA manual would be much more inspired.
Indeed, indeed. Lots to talk with you about tonight, especially some of your new research. But let me ask you a couple things, because in our November After Dark newsletter, there were a couple stories that really popped up, and I wanted to get a little bit more information just for myself. And I've done some research. One, of course, has to do what is called the Rhys map. It was basically, the map belonged to a Turkish admiral named Peri Rhys. He was one of the best-known military figures in the 16th century. Now, what this is, it's the map details the northern coastline of the Antarctica, a continent which was not discovered until 1818. And what they see is even more startling was the accurate depiction of the landmass, which was under the continent's massive ice cap, a landmass that would have been undetectable before 4000 BC and was only mapped out during the last century. Now, in addition to the so-called map, it also showed the interior topography of both North and South America with such perfect accuracy. Now, listen to this, Jason, that when it was eventually handed over to the U.S. Navy for study in 1957, the conclusion drawn by mathematicians and map experts was that the Rhys map had to have been composed, now listen to this, based on aerial photography taken from extremely high altitudes, a process which would have been somewhat cumbersome, don't you think, in the 16th century?
Amazing.
I mean, when you hear that, now that's one of two I'm going to ask you about.
Sure.
But when you hear that,
absolutely,
what do you think about?
Absolutely amazing. Well, you know, this information, again, you know, passed down, this map that you speak of, there are many stories of, you know, where does this information originally come from? And there is a specific location always cited, Mesopotamia, as to where this knowledge originates. And that will tie into what we'll discuss tonight as to who actually would have the ability to take aerial photography or pass that information down to people living on Earth, primitive people, mind you, to accurately tell them, here is the coastline of the land continent you are currently on.
And again, unless we had the capability a long, long time ago, sure, and somehow we blew ourselves up or who knows what happened, you have to think of this as somewhat extraterrestrial, because there's no logical way one could conclude that people living during these periods would have known about this.
That's right. Primitive man, as we know it, did not have the power of flight.
Now, what would you have done if somebody had handed you this map and said, now, look at this map, Jason. It was given to relatives of relatives of relatives in the 1600s, except that the Antarctica wasn't found for 200 years later. What would you have done?
I'd probably start getting a little nervous that I had that in my hands.
No. go insure it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's some pretty accurate information, and you know, the only sources that we have that we can cite for, you know, possessing that knowledge are the stories of that fall into the lines, like you say, of people that either come from the skies or you know, this ancient astronaut theory that we'll be discussing tonight. As we know it, primitive man using stone tools and living in clay huts, there are many feats and bounds that they seem to have accomplished or that we attribute to the megalithic monuments found all over the Earth that we still today don't have an answer for. So the only answer that starts to ring true is extraterrestrial intervention, or in the religious sense, that somehow there was a hand of God that intervened. And, you know, as we'll discuss tonight, that merging of the idea of the religious texts based on what we have in the Bible and other sacred sources, as well as modern science, are, you know, extraterrestrials real? So those two stories offer us, or those two lines of thinking offer us a lot of insight when merged together.
Now, here's another one that just knocked me out, and I've heard about this before, but it continues to baffle me. It says, one of the most astounding and certainly the best documented instance of primitive man being privy to information that he couldn't possibly have attained on his own is the strange case of the isolated Dogon tribe of West Africa. Among them, a French anthropologist lived for 16 years. By 1947 now, the tribal leaders of the Dogon had come to trust him enough to bestow this scientist with the tribe's holiest secrets. Expecting the sort of mythological tale an anthropologist might come to expect from the religious elite of a rural culture, he listened politely. His initial amusement was gradually replaced with a keen interest as the elders told him an intriguing account of the half-man, half-fish creatures who had been originators of human civilization on Earth. But what the Dogon told him next was absolutely shocking. It turned out that this small, isolated tribe had knowledge of astronomy that could not possibly have been attained without the aid of powerful telescopes and sort of advanced understanding of physics and cosmology that Western scientists had at the point only developed a few decades before. They were able to depict star systems, for example, that you could not see. Now, how in the heck could they do that, Jason?
Very interesting. You know, there was actually an article in the Skeptical Inquirer that speaks about this knowledge that this Dogon tribe possessed, and it's quite an anomaly. I mean, even to go on further, some of the things that they are aware of. And thank you, George, for making me abreast of this information. I need to look into it more on my own. But some of the things I've uncovered so far is that they actually knew of the rings of Saturn, the moons of Jupiter, the spiral structure of the Milky Way. And where our star lies within our solar system. And, I mean, they were giving this information out quite accurately in the fact that the only way you can see things like the rings of Saturn or the moons of Jupiter is with a telescope. And they didn't have any telescopes. So it's pretty amazing. And now they go on even further to describe they give a name, a reference of Nomos to this god that they interacted with that came and gave them this knowledge. And I need to look into this more, but it turns out there's some interesting correlations with an Egyptian god that also has the same look that the Dogons were
describing.
Describing, yes, correct. Now, we give the analogy of a fish man, half fish. But interestingly enough, just as we'll see in other symbology from cultures, you know, if you see a fish man or, let's say, an angel, a being with wings, it doesn't necessarily mean they were birdmen or fishmen. They were trying to symbolically tell us something.
And they could have been reptilian-looking men.
Exactly. That's another part I noticed the article touched on was the fact that, you know, when we see these descriptions, for instance, of, you know, like when the Incas first encountered the Aztecs first encountered the conquistadors, they thought these men were like angelic or had this superpower to be able to, from very far distances, take down their enemy with a gun. They didn't understand. So there are a lot of things with even with dragons and all this that if we look at it in the science of today with extraterrestrials and reports of could there be, you know, reptilian aliens as well. Again, you know, it opens a lot of conjecture to what they were seeing and what they were symbolically trying to tell us.
And I think what you'll find, as you even conduct more investigations, Jason, is that there will be all kinds of similarities that will keep cropping up between different civilizations that all tell very similar stories.
Very intriguing.
In your opinion, based on current knowledge, the first civilization on this planet, would have been whom?
Would have been Sumer, and that is basically where we have modern-day Iraq. And what basically led me to that is that, you know, as we're discussing tonight, you know, there's all this evidence from these ancient cultures that display a type of brilliance in their technology for mathematics and the way they did architectural achievements, some of the monuments like the Giza pyramids or the structures in Peru, Teotihuacan and Machu Picchu. They're absolutely amazing. And so we can't understand where they got this knowledge, accurate knowledge of astronomy and observations of the sky, or as we were discussing with this map. So it really starts to raise the question, who is the oldest culture? Where is this knowledge being passed down from originally? Where does it originate? Even in the biblical tales, we have stories in the Bible that people want to ascertain, is it true or not? So we start to use modern science to take a new look at this information and say, can we put facts behind these so-called mythical tales or religious beliefs and start to say what is true and what is not? Where does this information actually come from?
Now, in terms of the Sumerians, yes. How far back again are we talking about? What period of time?
The oldest culture that we have record of currently, meaning aside from the ideas of an Atlantis or this or that, the one that we have in the record books right now goes back to 6,000 years ago, basically 4,000 years B.C. You know, 4,000, 6,000, what's the difference? If you realize that we're basically about 2,000 years removed from when the time was Christ was here, 2,000 A.D. to B.C., so 2,000 years ago, Jesus was here. You go back another 2,000 years, you're at the time of Abraham, and that's 2,000 B.C. Another 2,000 years at 4,000 B.C., we're at the Sumerian culture, and that's 6,000 years ago, and that's where the first recorded civilization that we have on Earth shows up, modern-day Iraq.
As you got into this, and as I labeled you once before, you're a younger version of a Zachariah Sitchin, and,
yes.
and you jumped up and down saying, that's too big a compliment, if
you
remember.
Thank you.
What happened to the civilization, Jason? I mean, we go from point A to point C. What happened to point B? I mean, other than some texts that were left behind, nobody sees the flow here with them, with some of the Egyptians. I mean, where did these people go?
George, that's the question we're trying to, it looks as if our knowledge base on Earth has gone in a roller coaster event where we take these leaps of advanced technology and then we seem to somehow lose it, or something happens where we're forced to, lose possession of it. I'm not really sure what's happening, other than I can say that with the Sumerian culture, this first culture we have record of, this is the first culture that we have record of. Not only that, but we can trace it all the way to our modern culture, where all the things that we still use today are sources of original Sumerian knowledge. For instance, a lot of the things that we talk about in the Bible, we can now confirm as having an original Sumerian counterpart. There are stories that we have in English that tell us about, like, the story of Genesis, or we hear the story of Ezekiel's wheel. All these stories that get famed recognition in English also have a Hebrew version in the Old Testament. But that's not the original version. There are actually older Semitic languages, Middle Eastern languages, that if you trace back, it turns out that the oldest recorded language that we have comes from this first culture called the Sumerians, where modern-day Iraq is. Now, this first culture were the first ones to invent things like writing. They invented mathematics, agriculture, medicine, sciences, music, codes of law. Like, they were the first ones to announce a man takes a woman as a wife, marriage. All of these things, amazing amount. There's over 100 of them that I could list tonight that we attribute to the Sumerian culture as the first civilization on Earth.
Do you think there are people, descendants of them, running around the modern-day Iraq right now?
Of course. I actually get emails from people every now and then that will look at the artifacts stored in the British Museum, or copies that I have, stored on the website.
Or maybe even in Iraq now.
Yes.
Now that they're putting a few of them back, huh?
There are still many Assyrians and Persians and many other cultures from descendants of the Sumerian culture that are still alive, and I'm sure people that do genealogy can trace their records back. But the information that we've attained from this culture is really quite amazing, and some of the things, just to give you an idea, one of the stories was that there was this object found excavated from Baghdad that basically was a little copper jar, or excuse me, not a copper jar, it's a clay jar. But inside of it, it had a copper lining, and it was filled, or at least one time they assumed it must have been filled with some type of acidic fluid, like a wine or a vinegar.
It was a battery. Welcome back. I'm George Norrie, Jason Martell, my guest. Jason, let's talk a little bit more about this battery. What would they have used it for?
Well, in the early 1900s, many European archaeologists were doing excavations in ancient Mesopotamian sites, looking for evidence of biblical tales, like the Tree of Knowledge and like evidence of Noah's flood. And there was this one researcher that found this battery, you know, what he thought was a battery, or at least was very quick to make his announcement that he thought it was a battery. And at the time, you know, in the early 1900s, of course, this didn't sit well with many theologians and people that didn't want to, you know, put out of context what we thought, again, primitive man or the ideas of religious beliefs, that they were actually using batteries to accomplish certain tasks, like for, you know, maybe a battery for, you know, lighting and stuff like
that.
And we've seen some of this through the work of Eric von Daniken in various places in Egypt, where they found wall carvings and inscriptions that actually show what could be light bulbs. And he's actually, Eric von Daniken has done tests using electrolyte solutions, acetic acids, if you will, that using the same models portrayed in these inscriptions by the Egyptians. That you could actually make a working light bulb. So it is pretty esoteric information.
Well, you know, they could have been using it, too, to do platings, for example, on some metals. Who knows what they could have been. You know, when you use electricity like that, mm-hmm. you've got the ability, let's say, to melt a metal and then, let's say, coat it on something else.
That's right. So, you know, it's pretty amazing. And you know, as I'm going to kind of lead you in here, lead into here is the next topic is the, you know, as we were discussing this Sumerian information and this first culture that we have record of, I was doing a little research into the origins of writing, which of course are cuneiform. This is it's called cuneiform script, and this is the first recorded language that we have record of, and of course it's from the Sumerian culture 6,000 years ago. So I wanted to find out. Well, you know, this is very interesting, cuneiform. Where was the first recorded cuneiform script found, and how did we actually learn to decipher this language? And it turns out that the first cuneiform complete, like Rosetta Stone, if you will, that, that contained enough written language of the language for them to decipher it compared to other Semitic languages. And it turns out that in western Iran, there was this huge wall inscription found on the side of a mountain. This gentleman's name was Rawlinson, and he was able to basically, when they pulled up, you looked up on this cliff, and 300 feet up there's this huge elaborate drawing. And I have actually just uploaded an image to the ancientx.com website so that people can see it. It says Sumerian God coming to earth, but this is actually an amazing image. And what it shows is that from 300 feet below, they had to hike up. And this is how they got the first Rosetta Stone, if you will, of cuneiform to actually...
And this is a flat side of a mountainside?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they elaborately carved, the Sumerians at the time had carved out this elaborate drawing, which basically shows a Sumerian god, which they called an Anunnaki. An Anunnaki in Sumerian meant those who from heaven come to earth, is sitting among... some of his Sumerian followers, which are very nobly standing in front of him, almost bowing slightly, and coming down above them is another depiction of what they called the Anunnaki, these beings that the Sumerians called their living god.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming down in a winged craft. It almost looks as if he's flying something. And we have seen this several times and call it the winged disc. And so the reason why this is so amazing is this is the first Rosetta Stone, the largest spread of cuneiform that was perfectly preserved enough so that this gentleman, Rawlinson, was able to copy it down and get enough of it to decipher the actual language. And looking at the picture, if you get a chance to see it on the site, it's actually amazing because this gentleman is standing next to the inscriptions, and he can't even read the very first ones because they're, again, as he's standing there on the cliff, this carving is so huge and so immense that these writings were another 30 or 40 feet above him, and they had to get ladders eventually to get up that high and read all of the writing. It's just absolutely amazing how elaborate it was.
Now, Jane, what about India, though, and ancient Sanskrit? How old was some of this stuff?
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, and I actually have not... in the course of my research, branched out too far from the Sumerian cuneiform writings. Of course, I have an interest in Egypt, and the next thing I'm going to start looking into a little bit, as I promised a friend today who just handed me a book called The Book of the Dead.
Oh, yeah, Tibetan and Egyptian Book of the Dead. There are two of them, two different books.
Very intriguing, very intriguing. And so for me, I've, you know, again, aside from the broader correlations of some of the monuments and some of the just the artifacts that we find, analyzing the languages is really an esoteric task, and that's why, as the name I've dropped infamously now, Zachariah Sitchin, being a linguist that, you know, of 82 years, he's an 82-year-old man, and being a linguist of his knowledge, he was raised in Russia, he was born in Russia, raised in Palestine, and acquired, you know, a very intricate knowledge of Semitic languages and Hebrew.
Sure.
Hebrew. And so deciphering this language, the cuneiform, and comparing it to other cultures, you know, again, it's very, very high-level knowledge.
Well,
I think only 200 people in the world can actually decipher cuneiform.
If that, I bet.
If that. So I am somewhat, as I was not alluding to the point, is I'm somewhat still trying to wrap my brain around all the intricacies of the cuneiform, but as I learn it more and more, I can clearly see how it branches out into these other cultures like the Egyptians and even the South American, Incas, the Mayans. A lot of the symbology used, like you said, there are similarities.
Well, you may find, if you look into the ancient Hinduism of with Sanskrit, mm-hmm. that it might be, even be older than some of the Sumerian texts.
Well, I can't say for sure, George. All I know is that based on the research I've found, the origins for many of the things that we still use today, the foundation of knowledge that we have, things like writing, medicine, sciences, music, all of this, the only source that I found traces back to Mesopotamia. Now, there are, of course, this knowledge filters through all the cultures. So being able to decipher who was the first one that had this knowledge, it's still an open book, but for me, I can say pretty clearly that the Sumerians were one of the ones that stood out the most for having over 100, at least 100, of the advances that would be needed to have a civilization.
Well, and what amazes me about the Sumerians and the Sumerians' text is that it echoes some of the information of fallen angels coming down to breed with women on this planet.
Yes.
And what the Anunnaki did. I mean, there are a lot of similarities there, Jason.
There are a lot of similarities, and it's very interesting that the information that's told by the Sumerians, what we'll discuss tonight, a lot of the things, again, when the excavations first started taking place in modern-day Iraq, early 1900s, artifacts being pulled out show depictions of the outer planets, and are talking about the distance between the planets, and are showing depictions of what the archaeologists at the time called birdmen. They didn't understand what they were seeing and saying. Again, in the early 1900s, we didn't even know of many of the outer planets. We didn't discover Pluto until 1930. So a lot of the information initially discovered got thrown into a big thing called the myth pile and was untouched by modern archaeology. And it was left up to people like Eric von Daniken and Zachariah Sitchin, a very small few who have chosen to look at this information in the myth pile and say, well, look, all the other information from these cultures, we can now confirm what they were saying scientifically. So this other myth pile, let's start to dabble in there. What else does it say? What else can we confirm? And so this information is the part that has really intrigued me because, as you mentioned, it deals with more of the ethereal sense of dealing with meeting the angels or depictions of angelic beings. What does this actually mean? What are these stories? Where do these stories really come from?
On the Ancient X website, where can I find that wall? I'm on it now, and
sure.
I've got a couple people who want a little bit better direction.
No
here.
Problem. If you go to the Ancient X website, on the main page, scroll down,
uh-huh.
and the very bottom article, if you click that on the left-hand side, it's a little white image.
It says Sumerian God coming to Earth?
Correct.
All
Sumerian
right.
God coming to Earth. And that one will bring up a very full-page view.
Okay.
Of that drawing. And the gentleman, you can see him. He's standing there on the ledge. This is Rawlinson was the researcher. Very interestingly enough, this thing was so intricate, he had to stand on his tiptoes and point up as high as he could just to read as much as he could because it was such an elaborate, huge spread.
Is that a pretty accurate depiction of how the terrain is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, this is an actual depiction that was sketched out at that time and then preserved in... The book I have here is an actual author named Andrew Robinson. There's another gentleman by the name of Samuel Kramer, another famous Sumerologist that it's actually Sitchin's likes to cite a lot as one of his one of his...
What a neat picture, by the way.
Yes, it's amazing. Yeah,
you can, hey, maybe, Lex, you can grab that and put that up there and take the chupacabra down now. And, I mean, that's an amazing picture. You can see the guy in his little flying craft.
I think I was actually nice enough to send your webmaster some even more close-up shots of the wing disc or even that type of scene. But this is, again, that's an amazing... It's an amazing shot where, again, these artifacts and all the things that we have, we start to look at this stuff and start to wonder, what does it really mean? And what I'd like to touch on now is some of the more specifics. You know, as I said, the Sumerians have all this knowledge. They were the first ones to invent things like agriculture and medicine, music, astronomy and math. But what were they writing down? And one of the things that they were very accurately recording was astronomical observations of the sky. And several of the tablets now preserved in the British Museum, and of course I have them featured now on ancientx.com, is that they show very accurate astronomical charts and observations of the sky over hundreds of years, in some case thousands. One tablet actually shows whoever was able to decipher the cuneiform and could read this, whatever scribe was able to read this information, would be able to tell you 50 years in advance when a lunar eclipse would take place. Another one has very accurate observations of Venus over long periods of time. And the Sumerians were very very detailed in explaining the knowledge they had of the solar system. And in several instances, there are Sumerian tablets that explain the distance between the planets. And I should stop real quickly and explain what I mean by a tablet.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumerians basically used a stylus, which was a very wedge-shaped object, like a pen, but it came down to a wedged point. And they would use a flattened-out piece of wet clay and then would twist and turn and make all these characters based on somewhat of looking like a triangle. If you were to look at the cuneiform, it looks like a whole bunch of symbols of triangles
right.
all connected. But it was an elaborate 400-character system that once they would write out in the wet clay...
And they'd roll it out almost like dough, right?
Well, yeah, that was part of it. This clay could be used in two purposes, one for writing and one for pictograms. For
mm-hmm.
writing, they would just write in it, you know, the wet clay, and then put it into a stove, a kelm that they called it, and then turning the clay tablet into stone, literally keying that phrase, writing in stone. The other purpose, which still baffles archaeologists today, is that they used cylinder seals, which was a little tiny round, sometimes semi-precious stone, where they would reverse carve imprints that they would then, when pressed and rolled over with your hand into this wet clay, would leave the positive imprint, the image, just kind of like your like a printing press.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, just like a stamp.
Exactly, like a stamp. So they could very easily, the scribe could put this information onto the clay and very quickly roll out several copies like a newspaper and disseminate it throughout the village.
What kind of a mind would have been able to decipher that at the time? I mean, that's pretty good technology.
We still today are baffled as to how they were able to carve so intricately and in reverse these diagrams on a round stone.
I'm not sure I could even carve
I'm a designer, for a living, and I look at these things and some of the artwork, and it baffles me to the degree and accuracy, the shadowing and the depth and everything that they use is just absolutely enthralling.
The minds they might have had. How many do you think populated the planet at the time? How many people? Any idea?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not actually sure what the total population at its peak point for the Sumerian culture was, but that's an interesting question.
How did they live? Have we ever found any of their huts and homes?
Well, there have been several artifacts found to the point where even one of the cities in the Bible, in the Hebrew version that's mentioned called Ur, we actually found in Iraq that still is standing. The ancient city of Ur is still there, and it's amazing because, again, a lot of the stories that we have in the Bible, we can start to cite many of these sites and artifacts as actually still existing. For instance, Noah's Great Flood is not just recorded in the English version or in the Hebrew version. There is a stone tablet of the Sumerian original version, and it's, of course, stored and on display in the British Museum. Anyone can see it. And it accurately tells a story of how a Sumerian man was chosen by an Anunnaki, a Sumerian god. Anunnaki, again, means those who from heaven come to earth. An Anunnaki chose a Sumerian man and told him the knowledge to build a craft that would be sealed on all sides and could roll and basically matches and parallel the Noah's Ark version in English.
It is possible, though, that while the Sumerians were doing their thing, someone or somebodies in Egypt were building pyramids at about the same time. Don't you think?
Sure, sure. There are a lot of correlations and connections that branch out from the Sumerian culture that all these other cultures, picked up remnant pieces. And again, if we're talking about, as we're going to get more into the juicy parts, but the Sumerians, again, all this vast knowledge they have, they cite very clearly, and especially the astronomical stuff, which I'd like to touch on more, that they did not just learn this knowledge themselves. All that they know, they say, they learned from the Anunnaki, those who from heaven come to earth. So it's very easy to assume that if the Anunnaki were influencing one civilization on a part of earth and they were visitors, ancient astronauts from another planet, very specifically cited by the Sumerians, which we'll discuss.
Have any of the skeptics of the Sumerians ever stated why they would talk about the Anunnaki? I mean, would they make up a story like that?
They call it mythology. They reference this as bird men. They didn't quite understand. Now, there are various other depictions, and for instance, the earliest depictions of the zodiac, the 12 houses of the zodiac, and that key number 12. Again, the Sumerians were the originators of mathematics, having a base math of 60. Many of the things that we still use today, one of those was the fact that they had all these depictions for the different constellations, the bull, the Taurus, and the scorpion, all of these still being used today. At the time when the excavations were taking place, a lot of the symbology and things that they discussed, We weren't able to quite connect the dots just yet then. So a lot of this just ended up, as I said, into a big myth pile that was left untouched.
Almost
kind of like the Raiders of the Lost Ark, that scene with Harrison Ford at the very end where they roll off the Ark into this big room and it's stored off somewhere, hidden among all the other artifacts. It's very possible that, this knowledge has been known and it's just not being shared.
Welcome back. I'm George Norrie, Jason Martell, my guest. Jason, let's talk for a moment, if we can, about the winged disc. What does that represent in that culture, the Sumerian culture?
Sure. Well, wherever archaeologists uncovered the remains of the Near East peoples, Iraq, Iran, this symbol of the winged disc was always conspicuous. You could see it dominating temples and palaces. It's always carved on rocks, and you see it etched in all types of the cylinder-sealed depictions, the little reversed imprints that we were talking about. And it's always accompanied kings and priests, stood above their thrones or hovered above them in battle scenes, if you will. And the interesting thing is that, central to the religious beliefs of the Sumerians, again, is that they lived among their living gods called the Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki that they cited actually lived within a planet that's in our solar system. They actually cited all of the planets, as I was discussing earlier. They discussed the distance between the planets, but they also cited all of the planets that we know of, plus one additional planet that we still have yet to locate. Modern science has been doing some search for it, and it's known as Planet X. And that term has many meanings in nowadays world, but as we're discussing it, Planet X just basically meant Planet X, X room numeral 10, or X unknown. And so it's very interesting that the Sumerian culture were aware of 12 members, a solar system with 12 members. And so this depiction of the winged disc or the winged globe is basically the original, let me start off by saying, the winged disc is basically the symbol for this planet of the Anunnaki. They called it Nibiru. And that term, Nibiru, stands for planet of the crossing, which in turn, the initial Sumerian symbol for this planet, the home of the Anunnaki, was a cross. And now that's very interesting because, again, we're talking about a culture that's 4,000 years before, 6,000 years. No, that's right. 4,000 years before the time of Jesus and the whole idea of him being on the cross. The Sumerians depicted this planet of where the Anunnaki come from, these winged beings, which we in the Bible called angels. The original Sumerian depictions of these beings, they called the Anunnaki. And they said the Anunnaki lived on this planet called Nibiru. So this form of the cross, eventually, over time, was translated into other cultures as the winged disc. But when I say other cultures, I should say very in close conjunction with the Sumerians, where the Sumerians, in later branching out into Assyrian and then more prominently the Babylonian culture, would always use the symbol of the winged disc to pronounce their god or their main god, Marduk, or in the sense of the Egyptians, like their sun god Ra. But there are other sun gods from the Sumerian times, of the name of Shamash. He was depicted as a winged disc. And so this depiction of the winged disc is the Sumerian understandings of their symbology for the place of the nobles, or in the simplest terms, Nibiru.
But flight and space was all over their culture, wasn't it?
Well, yes, and that's, you know, the amazing thing is, again, you know, all of the knowledge that they left us, we still use today. And so one of the things that's very interesting, you know, aside from their knowledge of astronomy, was their knowledge of mathematics. They were the first ones. For instance, again, they used a base math of 60. You'd think maybe it would be like 10 or something, but it was actually 60, sexagesimal, very complicated, large-scale number of a base math to start with. The Sumerians were the first ones to give 360 degrees to the circle, 12 months in a year, 12 inches in a foot, 12 hours in a day, 12 in a dozen. All of this comes from the Sumerian information. And as again, just as I had stated, because this is kind of one of the key focal points to the Sumerian information, and unfortunately it does get convoluted with a lot of the speculation with Planet X in today's terms, but the Sumerian knowledge of 12 members in our solar system.
Right. And they counted from the outside in, right?
That's correct. The Sumerians called Earth, what we call Earth, Ki, and it stood for the seventh planet. And
which is what you would see if you were coming into our solar system as opposed to going out of it.
That's right. If you started at Pluto counting inwards, Mars would be six and Earth would be the seventh planet. So the only way that we could be called the seventh planet is if someone who had the knowledge that came outside in said, hey, guys, you live on the seventh planet. But the interesting thing about this key number 12 with the Sumerians, the 12th planet, and as I mentioned, how that filters out to 12 months in a year, 12 hours in a day, 12 in a dozen, well, there's religious aspects to that as well. 12 planets in our solar system.
12,
well,
we have, or 12 bodies.
12 bodies, right. We also have the 12 tribes of Israel, or the 12 disciples of Jesus, or the 12 Greek Olympians. And so all of this knowledge, again, that, you know, splinters out through all the other cultures and biblical tales, the source of this is this original culture. And all of the information they wrote down and preserved is in stone, unchanged. So we have English, we have Hebrew versions, but the stone version is unchanged. And interestingly enough, as Zacharias Sitchin has said in several of his attending lectures, there, you know, an interesting point is he'll hold up a Sumerian stone tablet in one hand and the English Bible in the other,
mm-hmm.
and say, well, this is paper and this is stone. Which one do you think will be around for another 6,000 years?
Exactly, exactly. Did they have an ancient library? You know, and I'm always fascinated by the Egyptian library, the ones that, of course, we've never found yet. But did the Sumerians have one?
A library?
Yeah.
They had several libraries. They were basically people who were entrusted with the task of being a scribe. Was a very noble task, and anyone who had the ability to basically read and write would store information having to do with writing and the tools that would allow a person to do this. And so a lot of the things as far as storing them, the excavations that have taken place, there have been like sacred cities. One of them I mentioned called Ur, where in certain parts there are an actual, I guess you'd call it a library or a repository of documents. And it was very interesting what they would do is they had very intricate ways of, it was almost like a shelves and systems of cataloging all of these tablets. Because again, you know, these aren't pieces of paper we're talking about. They're writing on huge stone tablets.
Yeah, how big were these tablets? I mean, could you carry them around?
You could carry them around, but some of them do get up to a pretty good size as far as weight. The actual diameter and thickness of some of these is relative to you know, what story was being told. But to give you an idea, one of the tablets, for instance, talks about observations of Venus, and I think its thickness is about 2 centimeters,
mm-hmm.
and it's about 17 centimeters in length. So they're not very large, but they do, in some instances, you know, this cuneiform writing, they will, like I showed in that one large wall drawing, it will span an immense area. But as far as the tablets were handheld, they were really kind of adequate about making them the size that could be easily carried. And they actually, what I was going to point out...
And stored.
Yeah, and stored, was they actually made little sleeves. Like, actually, there were stone sleeves where they found some of the tablets perfectly preserved in its stone sleeve.
Well, like a VHS tape is in its box,
yeah, exactly,
that kind of thing?
Exactly, like its own little vest or pouch.
Huh. It was well, like, pretty good idea. That's probably how Blockbuster picked up the idea. Huh?
There you go, exactly. So another point that I'd like to touch on that's, again, you know, this amazing knowledge the Sumerians had that we still use today. One of those is that, you know, they had all this accurate knowledge of astronomy. And another thing that they translated from astronomy that eventually adapted into astrology that we still use today. The Sumerians, and here's how it actually took place, and I find this very intriguing. The Sumerians were the first ones to divide the heavens into 12 sections. And basically what happened was, this is the whole idea of how we got the 12 houses of the zodiac astrology, if you will, is that the Sumerians divided the heaven into 12 parts, assigned certain constellations to each zone, if you will, that were identifiable.
Right.
And what they would do is, during the time of helichial rising, I always pronounce that helichial rising, I guess. It's basically the time just before the sun is rising, and you can still see the dark sky, and
mm-hmm,
the sun's rising,
mm-hmm.
and you can see the stars throughout. Like, if you're looking at the sun, it's rising, but it's still dark out enough so that you can make out constellations behind the sun. They are farther out, but to the eye, you can basically, as a backdrop, see when the sun is rising behind what constellations at this time of helichial rising. And so what the Sumerians did is they would look to this, they would look to the sky, and they would know at certain times of the year at what season they were in or what time of the year it was based on these different zones that they denoted that eventually became the 12 houses of the zodiac.
They recorded the position of the constellations.
Correct. And so the other interesting thing that why this is amazing is that basically the sun the earth in doing an orbit around the sun every 72 years is retarded by 1 degree, and over 25,000 years, it finally comes back to the same position that it was in, meaning when the Earth does an orbit around the sun, it doesn't come exactly back to the same spot it was in, and over 72 years, it's retarded by 1 degree, and so over 25,000 years, it gets, you know, it finally gets back on track. This is called precession, and the Sumerians were actually aware of precession, of this 25,000-year cycle. And, you know, this is, again, very, very esoteric information. And, again, when anyone researches this into the origins of where astrology or the division of the houses of the zodiac, all of this comes from the Sumerian culture. The Greeks would very clearly cite the Mesopotamians, which were originally the Sumerian culture.
I am interested in your thoughts on the Anunnaki specifically. I want to get your take on that and what you think the Sumerians believed exactly who they were.
Sure. Well, the Sumerians very specifically talk about living among their living gods. And the thing that's really struck me is that a lot of the things discussed, for instance, in the Bible, the stories of an Adam and an Eve or a Garden of Eden, you know, we can't really put that into a tangible sense. And it turns out that the Sumerian stories actually have very strong parallels to the modern biblical tales of interactions with living gods.
Mm-hmm.
So the Sumerians have very detailed accounts of, you know, doing chores for the Anunnaki, doing things that they're bidding, living among them, or in many cases how the Anunnaki actually took the sons of or the daughters of men and slept with them.
So you're convinced, Jason, that this group called the Anunnaki,
yes,
indeed came down to this planet?
Yes.
Do you think the Sumerians, prior to the arrival of the Anunnaki, were advanced Or did they pick that all up later?
Well, the Sumerians actually, as my research is explaining to me, the Sumerians originated because of the Anunnaki. The people that were here initially on Earth,
they were genetically altered, weren't
that's
they?
Correct. That's right. Correct. What basically happened is the Sumerians created the first round were called Lulu Amelu, and it was basically a very primitive worker, if you will. And this model didn't quite do the task that they wanted, and they eventually, and actually one of the main features of the Lulu Amelu was they weren't able to procreate. Now, what we're talking about, again, this is, you know, this is amazing information that is told by the first culture right out of the Stone Age. And so people, again, scholars first reading this thought it was mythology. They're like, well, we don't quite understand what this could mean. But actually in later times, when they started to look through some of the Mesopotamian artifacts, they did start to look for connections, like, as I mentioned, the flood tablet. So these stories having to do with the creation of the atom, as the Sumerians called it, not Adam as a person, they called it the Adam, which actually meant the earthling in Sumerian. These stories of the creation of the Adam are very detailed, and they say that specifically the first trial were called Lulu Amelu, and they basically took the pre-hominoid man that existed here, actually not the man, I should say, the pre-hominoid woman that was here, living among Earth naturally, the Neanderthal species, if you will, before Australopithecine, I guess, nothing that would be able to connect to us, if you will, a completely separate species. That's why there's still that missing link today, which is another topic. But what they did was is the Anunnaki took 20% of this ape woman, this Neanderthal ape woman here naturally, and combined it with 80% of their genes, and in their image and after their likeness, created us. And so the amazing thing about the stories of the Anunnaki preserved by the Sumerians is that we get a lot of insight into biblical tales for when they start to talk about how gods were jealous or how they took the daughters of men, or how there were actual feelings taking place or being displayed by these gods. Jealousy, as I mentioned.
Do you think the Anunnaki, do you think they were giants or sized like we are?
That's a hard question. I would say it's very possible that they could actually be larger creatures, in some instances seven to 10 feet, more genetically perfect. And the reason why I say that is some of the research, as explained through the work of Zachariah Sitchin, he's written of a series of books called The Earth Chronicles, and basically it very, you know, very strenuously details the accounts of these Anunnaki. But I would say, aside from that, there are several inscriptions and wall carvings that when you see these still preserved today in Iran, in Iraq, and of course I have many of these stored on X-Fax. Actually, I think if you go to Coast to Coast AM on the...
Oh, yeah, everything's linked up. Your
right
two websites are linked
there, you've
up.
Got a link that says Ancient Artifacts, and basically one of the sections in there is called Artifacts, and it shows several wall depictions of the Sumerians standing before a seated Anunnaki, who is literally a much larger human-like being.
Okay, now we know about the war between members of the Anunnaki, and it might even have been nuclear, right?
What happened
to them? Where'd they go, and why did they leave?
Well, I remember we touched on this last time, and there is some very interesting research, again, by Zachariah Sitchin and some geologists in the region of the Sinai Peninsula, which basically showed that Zachariah Sitchin very clearly pointed out that the Sinai Peninsula, which is basically where the Sumerians explained the Anunnaki first splashed down in the waters of the Mediterranean seas, they when they first got here, the Anunnaki came bringing all this information, but originally, I'm sorry, actually I lost the point of where I was just going to...
Is it getting too late for you, Jason?
Not at all. I was reading some other point I was going to discuss here, and I...
My question was: where did they go? I mean, we know that they had a battle within themselves.
Sinai Peninsula. Boy, that just spurs another conversation. Basically, what happened is that the Sumerians described this story that the Anunnaki, when they first splashed down in the Sinai Peninsula area, that's where they first set up their main launching pad, if you will, a spaceport. And there are several long descriptions that show a depiction, if you will, of the leader of this spaceport, an Anunnaki, a winged being, but he has kind of like a bird like a beak and stuff, kind of like bird characteristics.
Something like you would see with Egyptian stuff,
yes.
Right?
And the reason the Sumerians say that they gave him more of a symbolic reference for flight is because he was the leader of the spaceport, and he was more inclined to do more transporting of goods from this planet to an orbiting space station, if you will, or to their planet Nibiru. And so he was always constantly in flight, so they gave them more characteristics of actually looking like, if you will, a bird man. But these beings, as depicted by the Sumerians, very clearly are much larger in size than the Sumerians.
But where'd they go?
Well, that's the key question. I think the information, again, by Zachariah Sitchin is the best answer to that. He has translated several stories that say the Anunnaki had a falling out amongst themselves, different squabbles, and used nuclear weapons against another part of the family, and in the process wiped out not only a whole Anunnaki civilization, but many of the Earth civilization at the time.
Great looking websites, by the way, Jason. You've done a very good job putting all the pictures there. Of everything that you've looked at with the artifacts, is there any one that just boggles your mind?
Well, I got to stop and say something real quickly, George, if I might. I'm sorry, but just before the break there, you got a long pause out of me, and I've just got to say, I've been in the field, and I know a couple other people that every now and then, when they do high-profile shows like yours and others, get the exposure where they get contacted by certain people or get things offered to them. And I'm not going to share what it was, but just before the break, I received an email with someone showing me something, whether it's authentic or not, and it took my attention away, if you will. So forgive me.
Shame on you.
Yeah, but let me give you an example of
you know, as Mr. Miyagi said, concentrate.
Yeah, right. Well, look, let me give you another example of another offer someone gave to me. It's completely out of my league, but just to give you an idea, the last time we were on, one of the offers someone had given me or said was that they have footage of a Russian spacecraft docking with the International Space Station. And, I don't really know of much of an array of spacecraft the Russians have that we know of publicly. But, it's very interesting things that even when you do things like this, like your show, I can only imagine the information that you must get bombarded with as far as people presenting you with...
You get all kinds of information.
So every now and then, though, my point was is that something will pop up that will be like an eye-opener to be like, wait a minute. So...
Okay, well, okay. Back to the show at hand. Anything here that boggles your mind? Artifacts that you've looked at?
Well, there are many of the artifacts that boggle my mind, but I think one of the points that we haven't discussed, which the audience might be of interest, is that the Sumerians had a lot of knowledge as far as I mentioned, medicine. And one of the key things that they speak about, as we were touching on before, was the creation of the atom. Now, many of the things that we've picked up from the Sumerians and we still use today, if you go into your doctor's office, you'll see perhaps a medical plaque on the wall, the degree the doctor got in their schooling.
Yeah.
And it'll show two entwined serpents as the symbol for their medical seal. And this symbology of two entwined serpents actually comes from the Sumerian symbol for this god called Enki. And he was basically lord of the earth, if you will. And he was one of the Anunnaki that the Sumerians described, but he was one of the lead Anunnaki. And very interestingly, there are several tales and tablets with these cylinder seal descriptions. Remember the little reverse carvings, or I should say imprints, that very accurately depict this tale of how the atom was created and this process of how they tried many different combinations until, in one instance, the arm didn't work, the kidney didn't function, until finally they had this perfect working model. And, as you've asked, what were these beings used for? And this is where it gets really interesting, because all of the tales we have in, English biblical tales explain that, man served the gods, or served God, I should say. But, in other versions of these tales, like in Hebrew or other Semitic languages, there are plural gods. There are Nephilim even. There are offspring of the gods mating with human females. So all of this information, when interpreted, again, you know, if we look at it through religious terms, well, what does it really mean? Where are these beings coming from? And do they really exist? And so when we look at the artifacts that have been left to us, and as we, you know, the main topic for tonight is this symbol that we've seen, this winged disc, what are they trying to tell us? And I think, you know, throughout, time and time again, the information is clearly showing that the Sumerians weren't just making this up, and actually were being taught this by somebody, because there's no way they could have known it on their own.
They were witnesses to something. There's no doubt about that.
Witnesses to something, definitely.
Early in the program, you mentioned Peru. Was there anything specific about that region of the world?
The only thing other than the article that we were touching on earlier is the fact that there are other cultures that have been spread out even into other, you know, other continents that seem to have very accurate astronomical knowledge, or were able to build structures upon the Earth that are aligned astronomically, or just have a geometry displayed within them, repeating patterns that are just so accurate or so precise that we still can't, meet. And so the only thing that I would comment on that you might find of interest, and I'm not sure if this was what I had alluded to earlier, was a couple months ago, there was a tour going on in the Los Angeles Natural History Museum, where I'm currently located in Los Angeles. And they had a display of ancient Incan and Mayan artifacts from Machu Picchu and Tiwanaku and several other places that were actual artifacts from these locations. And I, of course, went there and filmed some of these artifacts and took pictures. And it was really intriguing because you could actually touch many of these things firsthand. And it was just really amazing to see the knowledge that they had. And, even the Mayan culture, with their elaborate calendar system, there's just so much evidence with these ancient cultures that even transferred into the New Age Americas, not just the ancient Middle East as we're focusing on tonight. This knowledge seems to be passed through many different cultures, and all of it seems to be cited, at least in text form, like by the Greeks or the Romans, who were big advocators of documenting things, all cite Mesopotamia, the original source being Sumer, the Sumerian culture.
Lots of similarities all around this planet, and it makes you wonder, how do these various cultures all have some of the same techniques? For example, you've got pyramids in China, you've got them in South America, you've got them in Egypt, they're all around the planet. How did they develop these?
Well, that's the key question. I think the answer, at least what's starting to make more sense, is there must have been some type of intervention. And, another area which we can kind of lead into here is that, these megalithic structures that we have, for instance, like the Giza pyramids, I mean, these are structures that have been speculated on, over and over. And most people now aware of seeing programs like, things on TLC and Discovery Channel, where we question modern-day Egyptology of saying that the Egyptian pyramids were built 2,500 years ago, where, in fact, through the work of, Robert Schock and other geologists have shown that there's been extensive watering on the Sphinx and in the Giza region. There hasn't been, rains for 10,000 years. Or, for instance, John Anthony West pointing out that using, computer mapping software of the sky, Redshift and various other PC programs, you can easily tell when the constellations are going to appear where in the sky, and basically you can chart even backwards in time as to where they were in the sky. And it turns out that the Orion constellation, those three stars, one being offset at the very lower corner, is a perfect emulation of the Egyptian pyramids, meaning someone, and I should say they line up, more specifically, they line up in the year 10,500.
Exactly,
BC.
Exactly.
So if someone was able to create a terrestrial map on the ground of the sky in 10,000 BC, and even more precisely, I think that the Sphinx is directly gazing at the constellation of Leo, which is a lion. So in 10,000 BC, we have the Orion constellation right up above, perfectly emulating the pyramids, on the ground, and the Sphinx is looking out at Leo.
And I think that face was a lion originally.
Could have been. But who built it, as you pointed out? And that would have been 10,000 years ago. And at this point, there is no recorded civilization beyond, as we've discussed, 6,000 years. The Sumerians are the first.
Let's go to some phone calls while we're chatting with you. First-time caller, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hello.
Nice to speak with you. What an honor. And you too, Jason.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi. Okay, my question for you is, you've mentioned the Assyrians. I'm dating an Assyrian. I've been dating one for about 3 years now.
An Anunnaki. Let's capture him. Bring him here to us.
Right. Well, you know what's fascinating is I've gone on your website and I've looked at all those fabulous tablets that you have up.
Yes.
And one thing that I've noticed is the star that's on there, the Assyrians use that on their flag. And my question is, I wonder if the Assyrians, how do they assign meaning to that? And the other thing is the Assyrians also have a publication that's circulated throughout several communities, and there's a large population of Assyrians in California. I've also seen the winged bull, and I've seen that again on those cuneiform tablets.
Yes. Well, let's see. To answer your question, the symbol, as I'm now looking at it here, of the Assyrian flag, very interestingly enough, yes, is the symbol for, as we call it, Nibiru. Now, this has, you know, several meanings in religious terms. As far as the culture you're talking about, it would be for the god Marduk. But this information, again, is the byproduct from the original source told in Sumerian. And so, for me, or anyone who looks at this, I think it's pretty clear that the similarities shown, at least by the symbology, that where did this originate from? It's from the Sumerian culture, and they very specifically tell us that this symbol denotes the home planet of the Anunnaki, and Anunnaki again being those who from heaven come to earth, more specifically Nibiru, the symbol of this winged disc.
Right. Well, so many Assyrians, and especially the ones in that I know of in California.
Yes.
As far as their religious beliefs go, many of them are what they call Catholics of the East. Orthodox. How do they reconcile this belief in the star and having it on their flag with the traditional Catholic beliefs?
You know, that's a very hard question. I, being raised as a Christian, for instance, had no knowledge of what we're discussing tonight, but has obviously prophetically, you know, transformed the way I, view religions in a sense like that. So I would say that, you know, it's really up to a personal interpretation and one doing their homework. But I think the correlations in anyone who does the research as far as the origins of these biblical tales, whether it be in Assyrian or Hittite or any other Semitic language, it seems at least clear to me that they all have a parallel in the stories and similarities of the beings they discuss and the stories being told. And the original, the oldest version, kind of like the chicken and the egg syndrome, is the fact that these all can be found in Sumerian stone versions. I will point out one thing, that through my day-to-day job-related activities, I hope to plan a trip to Israel in the next 6 months or so, where analyzing some more of the religious beliefs and asking people up front some of this information. It is very intriguing to find out people's beliefs when presented with the information in the light that I'm showing it.
I got to tell you, Jason, that looking at some of the figurines from the Sumerian artifacts, the Anunnaki, if this is indeed what they were making, I'm glad we don't look like they do. I mean, these are some strange-looking figures.
Are you looking at the ones with the large eyes?
Yes.
Okay, well, those are another very interesting aspect. I'm not sure if we still have the caller on the line.
She's listening on her radio.
Excellent. Okay. I didn't want to divert too much. But the point is, yes, George, those are another very interesting aspect of the Sumerian stories, is that the Anunnaki actually had helpers called the Igigi, and that these were beings that basically acted as though they were alive but were not.
Did they bring them with them?
They brought them with them. They actually assisted the Anunnaki in flying their craft and doing medical tasks and stuff like that.
They're robots or something.
They're robots, and it's very clear that there were all these instructions that the Sumerians wrote out as to how to tell if the being you were talking to was one of their android beings, if you will, as they cited, a being that acted as if it were alive but clearly wasn't. And it's a very interesting correlation to look at these beings, these little android helpers, if you will. I mean, if they're not human and act as though they are alive, I guess androids fitting. They look just like the modern-day gray aliens.
Yeah, they sure do. How would you like to find one of those in an old cave somewhere,
huh? No, that's okay. Oh, well, I thought you were going to say
not alive.
Alive coming at me or something.
No, just kind of there.
Well, who knows? You know, again, when we get into some of the more of the Department of Defense issues or classified information, we have all those lovely Stargate-type stories or whatever you want to call it of artifacts, which Zahi Hawass is clearly always denying, exists.
West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good evening. Hi, George.
Hi.
And thank you so much for taking my call, and Jason.
Hello.
This is a very synchronistic situation here. I just turned in my term paper for astronomy today, and it just so happens that I covered the Dogon of Mali from Temple's book, The Serious Mystery.
Very nice.
All of the galactic Mayan information. And I have also done about, I guess, 20 years of studying, starting with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Sanskrit Vedic text, and gone through a timeline to try to make sense and correlation of how it all possibly began. And so, of course, with your discussion tonight, I just had to call in. So I don't know where to start other than to validate a lot of what Jason is talking about, and about the Dogon of Mali specifically. They were aware of the star Sirius, they call star Sirius A, and the white dwarf star Sirius B, that the Dogon, every perihelion, 49.6 years, they have a big celebration, and they believe that they came from that star system. As well, they talk about the Ioannis, if I'm saying that correctly, the Babylonian and Sumerian being that is, what am I trying to say?
I don't know. What are you trying to say?
You know, the one with the tail and the amphibious creature.
The reptilians.
The reptilian amphibious creature.
Right,
that,
I think we were citing that earlier. I'm not sure of the actual name. I think I think the Egyptian one is Dagon, actually. It's Dagon in Egyptian. But there's an actual Sumerian counterpart that shows this being.
Welcome back. I'm George Norrie, Jason Martell, my guest, and of course you, your phone calls. Jason, Planet X, you are a believer in Planet X, are you not?
Yes, I'm a proponent of the hypothesis. Yeah, I believe in the hypothesis, if you will, of a Planet X.
You, of course, did not believe, like a few did, that it was rolling around on May 15th.
No. No, I actually had a conversation with Nancy Leader on a public radio show other than this one, discussing those views personally, of course.
And what did you think of her, by the way?
Well, I don't judge Nancy Leader as a person. I judge her information.
All right, what did you think of her information?
Well, I don't find it to be too credible. I for me, she is prognosticating several images up to the hundreds now, saying that there's images of Planet X on her website. And for me personally, they are all sun flares and lens flares and, I think you had Phil Plait on the other night, which I was...
Phil Plait, the bad astronomer?
Yes, I was actually impressed. It was the first time I had heard him speak. I was impressed with what he had to say, and at least the points he had spoke on, I was in agreement with him. Now, there is something, of course, of a discrepancy, which we'll discuss on the Planet X topic, as far as there being any type of legitimacy to an object being 4 to 8 Earth masses, if you will, and possibly being attached to our solar system in a very highly elliptical orbit, possibly way over 300 astronomical units out, very, very elliptical orbit. But, time will tell, but the evidence is there to say that something like that could exist.
Do you think the inhabitants, the Anunnaki, which probably came from that planet, no doubt,
yes.
Do you think they're still there?
Or is it a barren planet now?
It's a hard question. I would say that, the only research that we have on this, level of such an esoteric topic would be the one by Zacharias Sitchin. And he recently released a book called The Lost Book of Enki, where in some instances he likes to expand upon some of the Sumerian texts about the Anunnaki beliefs of life. And more specifically, he talks about this one god, Enki, and the writings of this main leader. So there is some information that can be extrapolated from those texts, but it's really hard to decipher what the beliefs of the Anunnaki were. But I guess only time will tell if we'll actually ever meet them again. I would say that more than likely this planet, if it does exist, probably is still inhabited. The Sumerians go on to explain very specifically how the Anunnaki could survive on a planet that has such a very long elliptical orbit, going very far away from the sun, if you will. That this planet is a very glowing planet, very bright glowing planet.
From within?
I'm not really sure from within.
It has no sun system, right? It's our sun, and how far away could it be by now?
Well, you know what? I sometimes give the idea that, for instance, like we have fireflies, we see natural luminescence in nature. There could be something expelling maybe from the core of the planet, or that the atmosphere traps it in such a way that there is some type of natural luminescence taking place. But we do know that it does have a dense atmosphere because it must trap. It has to trap in the heat needed to keep them alive. But they have written down that through their own technological rise to civilization, they've damaged that atmosphere. And that's why initially they came here to Earth, was to seek these precious elements they needed to repair their atmosphere. One of those elements
is gold.
Gold,
right.
Yes. But very specifically now, the Sumerian site, not to get off the topic of Planet X, they have cuneiform tablets and these cylinder seals that even show when Nibiru, or Planet X, if you will, was in the vicinity of Earth, that it was a bright glowing cross. And they showed tablets that showed, farmers plowing and then pointing up in awe at this glowing cross. So we have that information as well as the modern science view. Again, the Sumerian knowledge is quite prominent, the idea that there are 12 members in our solar system, another body beyond Pluto, where these Anunnaki live. Now, the modern science to this story is that, yes, basically in the late 80s, early 90s, this infamous scholar Zacharias Sitchin, the proponent of the Sumerian Nibiru, met with the lead astronomer for NASA, and his name was Dr. Robert Harrington. Unfortunately, he's deceased now. But that research has continued on in this ensuing decade, a little bit more quietly, because of the knowledge of the public for extraterrestrials and life on other planets has grown exponentially through the power of the internet. This topic of Planet X has become somewhat widespread, and unfortunately, this last topic we'll talk about with the modern view, there are a lot of facts behind this, and it has led to new hypothesis and speculation as to when it will return, this Planet X. And I am one of the believers that I don't possibly see this happening any time within our lifetime.
Probably not. And you're right about that, Jason, because if it's on a 3,600-year orbit,
yeah,
as Sitchin has told us, mm-hmm, and let's say it was close during the Sumerian period, which would be about, 6,000 years ago from now, which was 4,000 years before the clock started.
Right.
Let's say it was 4,000 years as an orbit, just as a
sure,
wash.
As a round number?
As zero started A.D., it was leaving again. It probably won't come back until the year 3,600 or 4,000 A.D., which is 2,000 years from now.
Well, I know at earliest best guess, we have some reports that, one of Sitchin's ideas that he will say in his conferences is that 2085 would be the earliest he would give it. And even for me, again, this is an esoteric topic, and I, not being an astrophysicist or an expert in, space measurements,
mm-hmm,
if you will, I know Phil Plait, had some interesting comments on this topic. I would say that the information out there does suggest, and as we commented last time I was on your show, like this Orpheus theory, one of the latest models says that a rogue planet you know, a huge intruding planet came in and whacked our primitive Earth, and that's how our moon was formed.
Well, scientists believe that happened indeed. And as a matter of fact, this planet whacked us twice. It bounced off and came back again.
That's correct. And so there are other signs within our solar system, for instance, that Uranus is tilted on its side and that Neptune has this odd orbit where sometimes it orbits ahead of Uranus and sometimes behind it. And so there are a lot of anomalies that at the time in the late 80s, early 90s, Zachariah Sitchin, who's again infamous for this Nibiru, met with the lead astronomer, Dr. Robert Harrington, who was doing all these orbital calculations saying, well, the reason why Uranus is tilted and Neptune has this odd orbit is that if we account for one more intruding planet, these effects can all be explained by just this one planet. And he went on to show an orbital path of this planet and its size being somewhat relatively close to Sitchin's understanding of Nibiru. So they documented all this on tape at the Naval Observatory in Washington, NASA's headquarters at the time. And, you know, it's pretty interesting information. And so since then, we have launched several satellites into space, and the research for the idea of some object that's causing these, you know, weird orbits in the planets, there were even mathematical perturbations is what they called that, which basically meant the outer planets were being pulled in a certain direction, which led them to believe there's something out there that's influencing this pull, Planet X. So they've been using all types of satellites since then, since the late 80s, one of them called the Infrared Astronomical Satellite. We have many up there now currently, the Chandra, CERTIF, the Space Infrared Telescope Facility. So I kind of keep my eye on this research, and I'm a very strong proponent in the professional community as far as as well as the amateur astronomical community in the belief that if there was a large object, I'm not talking about an asteroid or a comet, I'm talking about a planet.
Planet size.
That's correct. That this object would be sighted well in advance. We're talking maybe possibly decades before its arrival.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is based on the evidence of what we have been able to see with smaller bodies. For instance, Hale-Bopp also has a close, somewhat 3,500 to 4,000 year orbit in some, you know, speculated this is a harbinger for the return of Planet X. These are very esoteric topics, but at this point we go on the data, and the data says that no, there's nothing in the vicinity currently that is impending our doom. There is no Planet X by the sun. There is nothing approaching the solar system, at least in my opinion, within our lifetime that's a Planet X size object. Now that does not account for asteroids and comets, threats from space, if you will.
Which eventually will happen. Wild Card Line, welcome to Coast, you're on with us, and Jason Martell, hi.
Hi. I want to know what the Anunnaki looked like originally, and then they mated with the Neanderthal and created the Adam. I want to know what the Adam looked like racially, and I want to know what the Sumerians looked like racially, and I also want to know how far in the past did the was the Adam created from the time of the Sumerians? How far back?
Okay, let's see. Starting with the question that you just asked.
What do they look like?
I'm sorry?
What did they look like?
Let's start with that. What did they look like? The Sumerians were a very dark-skinned, dark-haired people. And if you look at the depictions of them, they all look to be more of it does look more of a Middle Eastern descent, if you will, that line of genes. But the Anunnaki themselves, as far as their appearance, seem to have a little bit more of a paler skin, mm-hmm. A little bit larger in appearance. Actually, their dimensions, as we discussed, they actually are taller. And as far as when the first Sumerian or being created by the Anunnaki appeared, there's two parts to that question. One is the Lulu-Amelu, the original version, was created basically around 300,000 years ago as a primitive worker to mine gold in southern Africa.
Adam?
I'm sorry?
That was the Adam?
The Adam actually came a little bit later. The Adam was the second generation of these primitive workers, the Lulu-Amelu.
And we're talking about the ADAM for people, not the ATOM, right?
That's correct.
Right.
The Adam, the
okay,
Adam.
The
and the Adam was able
reproduce.
To procreate.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. And what did they look like?
Well, they still looked like basically a Sumerian man. There are many depictions and statues and figurines left that show them as very biased men that had beards. As far as the actual color of their skin, I would say that it's a dark-colored skin, more of the Middle Eastern features. So that gene pool is still prevalent today, you know, and as one of the other callers pointed out, in Assyrian. So, you know, as far as, you know...
And you know, they're saying that the Garden of Eden originated right in that area, too.
That's correct. That's correct.
Which when you talk about the Adam and, you know...
There's a city called the Eden that actually exists.
You're right. You're right.
And this is discussed as the Garden of Eden.
So. Next up, east of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Enjoying the... this is Michael in Atlanta, and I'm enjoying the command of the Sumerian information. Something that you said earlier, George, about earlier civilizations possibly falling prompted this call. It's more of a comment than a question. Although I would point out for my own sanity... the saying that things were invented by the Sumerians is not necessarily possible to back up. They may be the first people that wrote it down. But, you know, the mummies that they found in Siberia had been in the ground 6,000 years, had clothes that are still wearable.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure.
And textiles found in South American Chile 13,500 years ago, still, and the shoes that people were wearing indicated probable agriculture, and I mean, there's no proof of it, but the getting on the stones that you mentioned earlier in southern Peru, I believe the guy's name was Dr. Cabrera, that found all these stones in the tunnels, seemed to indicate earlier civilization by far. I mean, standing in the room with the stones, there's thousands of them. And you look at them, and you just have no concept of how they came to be. And there's a couple of global maps that came up about to my knee, and they show seven continents and different coastlines, of course, but in different configuration, much closer to Pangaea, but obviously a view much, much older than 6 to 20,000 years.
Are you talking about the stones, correct?
Right.
Yes, I have a video of those. I think we touched on that earlier. I forgot the doctor's name, but that's correct.
And
he's got a huge collection of these.
Yeah, there's about 25,000 of them, as I recall. I mean,
25,000.
I saw several hundred of them at least.
Man with dinosaur, ancient maps of the world.
Right.
Absolutely amazing.
Men riding dinosaurs, men looking at the skies with telescopes.
I have a video of that. I should put that up on the web.
Oh, you should.
Video format.
Oh, and the one, I don't know if you got this one, they're on the beach at Paracas nearby. It's about 12 kilometers away from Ica, where his home, well, I guess his home's still there. I believe he's died a couple of years ago. But on the beach of Paracas, he found what appears to be a stegosaurus, petrified. You can see the ribs, and inside the ribs, there's a petrified human skull.
Oh, my gosh.
And these people were, the people that are drawn on the stones have a very different physiology than we do. Much larger head, longer torso, shorter legs. Look very different, but obviously an advanced civilization. I mean, you know, with the observing the skies and comets through telescopes and things carved into the stones. Of course, there's no way to date them, but very interesting information. And I was just reminded of that when George made the comment about where there possibility of earlier civilizations that the Sumerians are gathering information from, or the Anunnaki, you know, maybe have been before, you know. In earlier,
mm-hmm. I see, and I think we were. I think there were. I don't know what we were, but I think we were here a long, long time ago.
I do too. But as it stands right now, the first complete civilization that we attribute to things like writing and math and science as a whole rests on the shoulders of the Sumerian culture.
No doubt about that.
Jason,
tell me about this video. What's the name of the one that you said you have?
Well, actually, it's Dr. Lear's video. But Dr. Lear's a close friend of mine. He lent it to me, and I still have it. I have it here, right here, actually. And I just need to ask his permission to put it online, which, actually, since I'm his webmaster for Alien Scalpel, I don't think he'll mind if I just link it.
Probably not. And Roger loves Coast to Coast, so he'll say okay.
They are amazing. You might actually have him on sometime. He actually went there, interviewed this gentleman, and in the video, Dr. Lear is with
him. Yeah, I had him on about 8 or 9 months ago, but it's time to get him on again.
He's a good man.
I'm sure. Do you know if he's still doing the extracts of alien implants?
I don't know if he's taken out any recently, but he is, I believe, still, you know, if an interesting case popped up, would be available to coordinate.
Jason, the great flood stories, of course, the Hebrew version with Noah, the Sumerian flood version, how different, how similar?
Well, let's see. You know, the Assyrian, actually we don't have a Sumerian flood tablet. It's basically Sumerian influenced because it's in cuneiform script.
Okay.
But what we found was one of the tablets of a story called the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was this, it's one of the hugest, it's the longest literary work, excuse me, in Akkadian, which is the language of the later cultures of Babylonian and Assyria. And this tablet is interesting because on the 11th tablet, this long epic of Gilgamesh is what it's called in this Assyrian version. Again, it's a Sumerian language, but it's an Assyrian version. On the 11th tablet, it very clearly tells the exact same story of we have in the Hebrew version and in the more prominent English version of Noah, how Noah is forewarned by God to build a great ship that will supersede a great flood and carry out mankind, where he takes the animals two by two. But very interestingly enough, you know, we do have, again, this original version of this story, and I think it was 1872. It was originally found by an archaeologist. Actually, it was an assistant to the British Museum named George Smith, and I remember reading the article about when he had first discovered finding, you know, this tablet and taking it. You know, he ran up out of the room with his hands up in the air, shouting, I can't believe it, but taking this information in front of other archaeologists at the time, in the early 1900s, or I should say late 1900s, they were all very perplexed and thrown back and could not believe that here we have for the first time biblical confirmation in stone that the stories in the Bible actually have an original counterpart as the original source told in stone. There were other versions in other languages found, but this is the earliest version found.
Yeah, but it doesn't surprise you that there are tremendous similarities here then?
Yes, it's actually quite amazing that the details are left the way they are. It's kind of like the telephone game where if you said God is coming and then it comes back to you after passing it around the world, it says God is coming to you with blue hair and a green spaceship or something. It's the same message but just slightly tweaked. And to give you an example of what I'm saying is, for instance, the Sumerian tale, the Assyrian version of the Sumerian tale, is very accurate in describing all of the events that took place, and they completely parallel the English version. For instance, a Sumerian man is chosen by an Anunnaki, his name is Enki, to build this craft, and after this, the huge flood takes place, this craft rests on Mount Ararat.
Amazing.
And it describes the same process of how he lets out a raven and tries to find out if they can see if there's land anywhere near, if the bird finally returned one day with a branch saying yes, obviously the waters have subsided. And this is a Sumerian version, which is directly paralleling the English version.
All right, let's go to some more calls. First, let me tell you, too, that the five explosions have just rocked downtown Istanbul in Turkey. Suspected car bombs hitting targets, banks, the British consulate, body parts all over the place. Just happened not too long ago. Let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Tim calling from London, Ontario.
Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
The reason I called, I'll get to in a second. I actually have two quick points before that. First one is for you personally, George. I don't know if you've heard of Christopher Knight and Robert Lomas. Are you familiar with them?
Lomas, yes. The first person, no.
Okay. They've written books together. Now, I don't know if you've ever had them on the program, but I think that if you had them on the program, it would be probably as interesting as this program.
We'll look into it.
Excellent. Okay. The other quick point was, you guys addressed it earlier about the pyramids lining up with the Belt of Orion. I think that, not enough attention is focused on that. Perhaps more attention should be focused on that. And the reason I called, though, is to do with the idea of the planet coming back around. Now, when I was reading Sitchin, he said that the Great Flood happened roughly, give or take, 11,000 B.C., if I'm not mistaken. And then he said that it comes around once every 3,600 years, but he doesn't know when it's going to come around again. Well, simple mathematics would put it at roughly 3,400 A.D. if it was to come around again, by my calculation.
Which is what I did, too, exactly.
So.
All right, thanks for that comment. By the way, Graham Hancock has written about the Orion tie-in to the Sphinx.
That's correct, Fingerprints of the Gods.
And he did a great job doing that. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is David from Las Vegas.
Hi, David.
Hi, George, as usual, you always ask the questions that I wanted to ask, but let me try this anyway.
All right, ask one I haven't yet. Go ahead.
Okay. You mentioned briefly the fact that the Anunnaki are gone because they nuked each other. My question would be, wouldn't a civilization that was that advanced, first of all, have gotten past that? And second of all, I guess the phrase, what have you done for me lately, comes to mind. And in that, this is 2003. It's great. It's essential to know what happened 6,000, 10,000 years ago. But do you see any presence of Anunnaki today?
Okay, well, I would say as far as what's going on today, very interestingly enough, as we had pointed out earlier in the show, it just is a, you know, a speculation point, but these android helpers, if you will, of the Anunnaki, these Ijiji, look very much like the modern-day gray aliens. And so I have speculated, actually an article I've posted on AncientX.com, Ancient Aliens, it's very possible that... you know, we have all these reports of people being abducted by these gray aliens, and what basically happens is a medical checkup or things having to do with reproduction. So it could very, very well be that these Ijiji, these gray aliens, are some type of hybrid race also created by the Anunnaki and are here overseeing us, also another key term all throughout there known as the Watchers. So it's very possible that these Ijiji or these gray aliens... Now, this is just a speculation, of course. There could actually be real gray aliens that are alive, and they just did some genetic engineering on them to create a new race, an android race, if you will. But it's very possible that the same references we have today of abductions taking place could be this over-encompassing experiment by the Anunnaki, and they're just keeping tabs on their experiment.
And as far as where the Anunnaki went... you said they nuked each other out?
Where they nuked each other, here's how I would answer this, is that the Anunnaki, you know, you'd say, well, what do they look like? You'd say, okay, well, we were created in their image and after their likeness, meaning we as an advanced culture now, having space technology and the power of flight, have not obviously conquered, as George just pointed out with the bombings in Istanbul, have not conquered a peaceful civilization. And that's the key proponent which will be needed if we are ever to actually become a member of a galactic community, if you will. So I would say that, it's very speculative as to when they're going to come back, but where they went, I'm not really sure. It's very possible that we're just in a quarantine state, if you will, right now, and we're being slightly nudged in the right directions to make decisions on our own, if you will, to become more of a peaceful society and quit blowing each other up.
If they went anywhere.
If they went anywhere, that's my point, is it's possible we could be quarantined, if you will, from contact until in such times that we're not going to abuse the technology or the attributes that we would gain. Because as we've learned, it seems that each time there's an interaction with these advanced beings known as the Anunnaki or possibly other creatures, we take a leap in advance in technology. We don't want to blow ourselves up again.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
I have a question for Jason.
Sure.
Yes.
Thing.
When you were talking about the pyramids being lined up in formation of Orion's belt,
yes,
it made me think of a question. Is there any evidence of a civilization prior to the Sumerians? Are there any artifacts that archaeologists have found, or remains or tombs or anything like that?
There has been all types of uncorrelated things found, discoveries made, as one of the callers had just pointed out, mummies in Siberia, artifacts all around the world. As I mentioned earlier, there had been artifacts found where dinosaur prints were in the same lines of man footprints, or footprints of man with Neanderthal. So there are all types of cave drawing evidence and stone artifacts and biological evidence, which point to the fact that there has been something going on this planet for a long time. And as George pointed out earlier, with a 4 billion lifespan of our Earth, 4.7 billion years or whatever it is, our Earth has been around for a long time. So there's got to be many stories that have played out, and we're just a very small pinprick as to what has really taken place.
Great. Thanks for that phone call. Wildcard line, let's go to you. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George.
Good evening to you.
And Justin. Hey, thank
Jason,
you.
Jason, close.
Yes. Thank you guys so much for being there and putting this information out. What was hidden is going to become known.
Amen.
Yes. I'd like to throw this out there about the Sphinx. They did very good artwork when they carved this thing out with the body, but a lion's haunches are above its abdomen. A dog's isn't. The tail's wrong. It's not a lion's tail. That's bushy. I propose that this was originally a dog's head. With procession, you'll get an alignment with Sirius. The pyramids. We have another big connection there.
Do you have any proponent time frame of as to when
it was built?
Correlations would be made?
We've also proven through geologic studies that the Earth has shifted in its polar, where the pole's been. Look at our pole now. It's
sure.
practically
many
blank.
Times it's jumped.
Yes. Hawaii once used to be the North Pole. This will happen again. We have the group conscious thing going on. Let's pull for global disclosure. We want all the information because it's all here. Keep up the great work. We got to get all you guys together and do this. We want global disclosure. It's time for the truth.
How about that?
Oh, well.
He knows something.
Yes, yes. Very motivated. We have a lot of motivated people in the audience, as I've learned through the years. And, man, I tell you, more power to people, anyone who is willing to challenge the over-empowering government or anyone who stands in the way, because I don't think we're ever going to get an answer from them, so it's more power to you to keep fighting that uphill battle.
What do you think the Anunnaki would say if they came back here today?
I would hope that one day they would accept us as our equals. Based on the Sumerian information from the tales of when they last interacted with us and when they left after the great floods, giants upon the earth in those times, if you will, it's very clear that they were beginning to look upon us as a new light. Because after the flood, you know, they wiped out everything. And all of a sudden, this one ship of man rolls out and has still living animals, and instantly there's a story just like in the Sumerian as well as the Noah version. Man starts to create fire and heats up meat. God smells the meat, comes down and says, boy, aren't we grateful that you guys are still here to give us food.
You don't think they'd say, oh my gosh, what happened here?
What happened here? I think maybe they, you know, again, George, who knows? I would say that hopefully within my lifetime we'll get to meet these ancestors of ours.
West of the Rockies, your turn. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, my name is Dominic.
Hi, Dominic. Go ahead.
I'm from Orange County, the OC.
Nice.
Beautiful
girl in Orange County.
Yeah, I just wanted to say my grandfather's been listening to Art Bell and you since 1988, just to start off, and
wonderful.
I'm a student. I'm a college student. I had a question for Jason. Awesome
yes.
show tonight, guys. Reading about older ancient civilizations, you hear about Thule, Thule, and the Nordic race, and a lady called in earlier about what race the Anunnaki were color-wise. Are these people like Nordic people and blue-eyed, or, you know, how does that play in?
Well, that's an interesting question. The Nordic is a very confused topic because it gets tied into a lot of modern-day reports of abductions where the overseers are sometimes looking just like a Nordic figure, very good-looking, blonde-haired, blue-eyed women and males. As far as the Anunnaki go, they're a little bit more in the terms of bias, as far as they had the beards, and some of them were depicted as far as very masculine, but it's very hard to decipher as far as what their actual makeup could have been.
Excellent.
Other than the depictions that we have, and so, you know, we can only go on those. They are pretty accurate, though, I must say.
I checked out your website. Great website, and I wish you guys the best.
Absolutely. It's the androids that surprise me, Jason.
Again, how accurate is it? Because those things look, again, just like what people are reporting today.
They do. I mean, that's what the Greys look like, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it could have been a modified version of what we have today.
Well, next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is Kerry in Oklahoma, and I had a quick comment and a question for Jason.
Yes, sir.
First of all, the comment is a gentleman earlier had said something about a stegosaurus with a human skull
in there.
Right. Now, I'm not a paleontologist, but I'm kind of under the assumption that that stegosauruses were actually herbivores. I'm not sure.
Well, that would have been real interesting then.
My question kind of pertains to a rumored, fabled book written by the Mad Arab, Abdul Azarad, who was a Sumerian. I've researched this, and I've heard both sides, right? It's true, it's not true. Detailed explanations on both sides. I wanted to see if you knew anything about the book, the Necronomicon, and any kind of actual is there validity behind that story? Did this really take place in Damascus?
That's a very interesting question. You know what? I need to do more research on that topic. Here's the only answer I can give you: is to say that anything with good and evil. Mm-hmm. There's always a yin and yang. There's always a plus and a minus. And it seems that the Sumerian information also has some evil counterparts as far as there could have been, just like we have in the English version of God and the devil, there could have been other things happening with other parts of the Anunnaki race that were very bad. And I'm not really sure how that plays out, but there are stories that took place where, you know, that there could have been some very, very hard to explain things taking place, but it leads credence to the idea.
Probably greed got to all of them, Jason.
Yeah.
Hey, quick question before we say sayonara tonight.
Okay.
What about the possibilities that Nibiru was not a planet, but merely a huge mothership?
Yes. I first was introduced to that idea when Hale Bopp was coming around, and I could look up in the sky and see Hale Bopp and go, okay, well, is there a huge spaceship behind Hale Bopp? Many of the images from credible... Okay, real quick one. I got to.
Well, we don't have that kind of time. I've got 10 seconds.
All right. Well, again, I would say that it is possible that we'll see the planet X through some long range telescope, maybe within our lifetime.
Might it have been a spaceship? Yes or no?
No, I don't.
You don't think so? Okay,
no.
Because I looked at that and said, well, maybe that's what they thought.
Yeah,
it
I would
might
say
be.
By composition there might be some analysis done through infrared astronomy, but no, my analysis is probably just a big planet.
Websites linked up with coasttocoastam.com. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
All right, absolutely. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you again on our next program. Be safe, everyone.